This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. We're ending the year with our series Last Laughs, featuring some of our more entertaining interviews from 2004. Our guest Dan Aykroyd was one of the founding cast members of Saturday Night Live. Along with another not-ready-for-primetime player John Belushi, Aykroyd created the Blues Brothers, two blue-eyed soul men who dressed in black. Aykroyd played Elwood Blues, and Belushi was his brother Jake. The Blues Brothers' success led Aykroyd to co-found the nightclub chain The House of Blues. He also hosts the program The House of Blues Radio Hour, and now he has a book of interviews with musicians that were recorded for the program. It's called Elwood's Blues, Interviews with the Blues Legends and Stars. Some of the musicians featured in the book include Bobby Blue Bland, Charles Brown, Ray Charles, Bo Diddley, Buddy Guy, and B.B. King. Aykroyd has also starred in many movies. His latest is Christmas with the Cranks. Terry spoke with him about his early career, his days at Saturday Night Live, and the Blues Brothers. Let's start with a song from the original Blues Brothers film.
We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. We would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We certainly hope you all enjoy the show. And remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there's still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody.
Dan Aykroyd, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you and Belushi start the whole Blues Brothers routine?
In 1973, John came up to Canada to recruit for the National Lampoon Radio Hour. And I was in Second City with Gilda Radner and with John Candy. And John came into Toronto and he joined us on the set of the Second City stage, and we did an improv set. And then we went back to my very famous speakeasy called the 505, which opened after 1 o'clock after the Liquor Control Board of Ontario closed most of the bars in the province. We had a bar at the corner of Queen and River at 505 Queen Street, and all the streetcar drivers and cops from, like, outlying regions and waiters and waitresses and dancers would come to drink, and I had a record on by the Downchild Blues Band out of Toronto, Donnie Walsh, an incredible seminal artist out of Canada. And John, when I were listening to it, and John said, "What is this? It's a great record." I said, "Oh, it's just a local blues band. Blues, I'm from Chicago. I hear the blues now and again, but I'm into heavy metal," he says. I said, "Well, John, you show me heavy metal and I'll show you the blues." So we started to kind of talk about it and listen. And Howard Shore was there that night. He's, of course, the great Oscar-winning composer of the Lord of the Rings trilogy music. He was the original musical director on Saturday Night Live, and he was in Toronto at that time and had dropped by the bar. And he said, "Yeah, you guys should start a band, and you could call it the Blues Brothers." And we started to correspond. I didn't go back to New York with John. He'd managed to get Gilda to go back with him. But we kept in touch on the phone, and we started to look at material and develop material, and we did our first gig in New York in the Lone Star Cafe, and our backup band was Willie Nelson with Mickey Raphael, one of the greatest harmonica players ever. And Willie understood what we were trying to do, like so many that came along and joined us. They understood that, okay, these guys aren't the greatest musicians or singers or dancers, but what they are great front men, and they love and respect the music. So the hat and glasses are from the John Lee Hooker album, House of the Blues. He wears those shades and that hat on the cover there. The suits, the black jacket and thin tie and white shirts were because, you know, a lot of artists in the 60s kind of, you know, who were progressive and maybe were getting in trouble with the law, like Lenny Bruce, wanted to look straight. And so it was kind of trying to get that IRS look together to kind of fool the straights was where that came from.
Now, I read about you that you had a pretty strict Catholic upbringing, that you went to Catholic school.
Seminary.
Seminary. Wow, okay. Mm-hmm. So you're growing up in Canada. You're going to a seminary. And listening to blues and rock and roll and rhythm and blues.
And seeing guys on stage in my high school imitating Mick Jagger.
Right, okay.
Imitating the Animals.
Okay, that's where I'm heading. Long before you became part of the Blues Brothers and you developed this kind of alter ego for yourself, did you have a pose when you were in high school? Did you want to be black? Did you want to be a blues musician? Did you want to be somebody who you weren't and kind of take on that pose in real life?
Sure. I wanted to be Paul Butterfield and Charlie Musselwhite, and I used to walk around in a long trench coat, a long brown trench coat with shades, and I'd slick my hair back, and I'd try to find any little band up in the bars up in the Gatineau and up in Ottawa and Hull and where I was living, and I would just take off from there. And, of course, you sing like the people that you want to emulate and people that you admire.
Dan Aykroyd, what kind of acting did you do before the Saturday Night Live era when you were still living in Canada?
I did high school plays, and in college I was a stage manager with the Sock and Buskin group at Carleton University, which is a great school in Ottawa, Canada. I was a terrible stage manager because I wanted to be an actor. The producers and directors of these shows sensed that, and they kind of let me come on stage. We did Tom Paine. I played the King of France and a few other things in there. And I basically, just little stuff. Did some guerrilla theater, some Ferlinghetti and that type of stuff. Anything to kind of get out there and get involved and have fun.
No, I read that you did some TV commercials before Saturday Night Live. Is that right?
I had a production company with Dave Thomas, who, is the genius, one of the geniuses behind SCTV. We had a radio commercial production company, and we did some radio and television commercials in Canada when we were growing up.
Well, you did so many really funny commercial parodies on Saturday Night Live. Did you ever do the real thing? Did you ever do the equivalent of of the Bass-O-Matic or those Ronco commercials?
Really? Absolutely, yeah.
what did you do ads for?
Well, one of my first jobs in broadcasting was working for CITY-TV in Toronto, which was this station. I was a game show announcer. And I also did the shot box announcing. So I actually had to do that fast rap stuff for car companies and beer companies and all that. So, sure, I was actually doing it professionally when I first started out. I was hired by none other than Ivan Reitman, who we went on to do the Ghostbusters thing together.
Let me ask about one of the parody commercials you did, and this is the Bass-O-Matic. It's like a blender that turns fish into a delicious shake.
People remember.
Tell me how you came up with this, and if it relates to a real ad that you ever did.
Oh yeah, no. Well, my aunt, the late Hélène Goujon, she was a lovely woman, my mother's sister. She was in fact the Julia Child of Canada.
Really?
She had a television show and a cuisine shop in Montreal during the '60s, and I went to her house for lunch, and she was a master gourmet chef, and she was very well known she was on the network, the TV up there, and she said she was making a fish soup, and I saw she dropped the whole fish into the blender. I see, with the bones and everything, She said, no worry, the bones. You pick the bones out like you're eating a filet. Don't worry about it. And I never forgot that. And then, many years later, I was sitting with Paul Simon and Lorne Michaels and Elaine, and Chevy and John and I were there. Belushi, Simon, Paul Simon, me, Lorne, and Chevy, and we're sitting there. And, and we were just kind of laughing over things, and I was thinking about that. And, we were eating a meal, and I thought, I got this idea for, a scene, Bass-O-Matic. And when I said that, Paul Simon, who's probably one of the most brilliant people ever in entertainment, he started to really laugh. And it's hard to get Paul to laugh. Because he's so intellectual, so smart. You got to be at a certain level. When he started to snort, I said, "Man, I got something. If I can make Paul laugh this easy," and I went away and I wrote the scene based upon that night and my aunt's real experience with the fish soup.
How many times has this happened to you? You have a bass. You're trying to find an exciting new way to prepare it for dinner. You could scale the bass, remove the bass's tail, head, and bones, and serve the fish as you would any other fish dinner. But why bother now that you can use Robco's amazing new kitchen tool, the Super Bass-O-Matic 76? Yes, fish eaters, the days of troublesome scaling, cutting, and gutting are over. Because Super Bass-O-Matic 76 is the tool that lets you use the whole bass with no fish waste without scaling, cutting, or gutting. Here's how it works. Catch a bass, remove the hook, and drop the bass, that's the whole bass, into the Super Bass-O-Matic 76. Now adjust the control dial. so that that bass is blended just the way you like it. Yes, it's just that simple.
Wow, that's terrific bass.
I hope you don't mind talking about this, because I'm sure you've been asked so much. But the sketch that you did several times with Steve Martin, The Wild and Crazy Guys, the two.
I don't mind, Terry. Great. It's all right, please. I enjoy talking about these great times. And you, as an American female, should know I am no threat to you. I am so distant from you now. But if you were close to me, maybe then you might have to fear what I would do.
How did you come up with the characters?
Well, Steve had this guy called the European continental character, who was very suave and very continental. And then I had this, you know, Czech engineer who had moved to New York City and was kind of disoriented in the culture. So we blended his character and my character and came up with the Wild and Crazy Guys.
Who had you observed that inspired this character who thinks he's a real, like, American swinger?
Well, just, mostly it was guys I met in bars over here, you know? Uh-huh. The guy who told me the story about running from the tanks. You know, he was a Czech, immigrant, and he told me about running from, you know, during the Dubček era, running from the Soviet tanks. And I was just enraptured by his story here, you know, and how as a student he challenged the tanks and ran from the tanks. I ran from the tanks, and here I'm in New York. And I mean, it was sort of a real swinger character that I met in a bar. So I don't know where he is now, what his name is, but he definitely was responsible for me starting to originate that character.
What did he tell you about the foxes?
His whole modus operandi was the gold chains and the polyester shirts, and, you know, the whole thing about his existence was to try to get some great foxes to come home with him. And, I wasn't into the swinging scene, but I was, you know, in New York, kind of single and living at that time, and he was just one of these characters. I was just... made me agog. Why do they really exist? I mean, how could a woman even talk to this guy for more than 10 minutes? You know, you just want to run from him. But I didn't. I sat there and I pumped him for whatever he had to do. I think he was selling plumbing fixtures at the time. He was like a very sophisticated, in terms of his education, he was an architect and an engineer, but he was selling plumbing fixtures. And he was really fascinating. And I just, you know, there was one night in a bar that I met this guy. And from that, you know, you get the wild and crazy guy.
Did you ever laugh uncontrollably during a sketch and not, you know, and kind of lose what you're supposed to be doing?
No, I was, we really, John and myself and Billy, we really, that was something at Second City that we were really taught not to do that. Because you don't want to break the integrity of the scene, and that was really important to us. And that discipline carried over into Saturday Night Live, and I was not one of the ones that broke up. I mean, later on, we used to see people do it and that, but it was something that that John and Billy and I really didn't, we didn't like it when it happened. I think during the Nerds, where I'm the fridge doctor there, and I come over, and you know, Billy's there with Gilda. They were cracking up, and I can understand why they were cracking up, but, you know, it was something we prided ourselves in not doing. If we could prevent ourselves from cracking up, we really prided ourselves. And after, like, a scene or the show, we'd go, well, boy, it was tough to get through that one because, you know, the temptation was there to just laugh at your fellow performers. But I think the Second City training really, really lasted.
Dan Aykroyd speaking with Terry Gross. Here he is with Steve Martin.
Ah, that Fox Bar was really something tonight. It was no difficulty to see many swinging Americans enjoying each other a great deal.
And here is a thing I will tell you. The two most swinging foxes had the huts on for us and are coming here tonight to let us hold on to their big American breasts.
There's nothing preventing them. After all, there's no other pair of Czech brothers who cruise and swing so successfully in tight slacks.
We are two wild and crazy guys.
That's Dan Aykroyd and Steve Martin in a Saturday Night Live sketch. More with Dan Aykroyd after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Dan Aykroyd. He has a new book of interviews from his radio show, The House of Blues Radio Hour. The book is called Elwood's Blues. He spoke with Terry Gross last month.
I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes when I'm preparing an interview, I'll read something about someone, and I'm not sure if they really said that, or if it's really true, because it sometimes isn't. So let me read you something that I read that you had said, and you can tell me if it's true. And if it is true and it's too personal, you can tell me that as well. But I read that when you were 12, you were diagnosed as schizophrenic, and that you had heard voices in your head, and that you had to kind of keep that under control.
Well, it was more of a Tourette's thing than schizophrenia. It was analyzed as a Tourette's and Asperger's, which I still have a little bit today. I grew up being pulled one way by my mother, who was very, very strict, and then being relaxed by my father, who was very passive. And I had the Tourette's pretty badly there, and I went to a therapist about it. And at 12 years old, was able to have the luxury of sitting down with a therapist and talking through all kinds of things, books, music, and she was quite influential in kind of evening me out. But it was not so much. I think when I said that, I was kind of going to the extreme. It wasn't so much the schizophrenia part of it, but it was the Tourette's, Asperger's, which can be associated with hallucinogenic voices and that. And I still have a little touch of that today. I've been able to kind of defeat it without pharmaceutical medication. I just find in my research and reading today that there's a lot of people who have this kind of mild condition, and some of them get over it, and some of them it spins out where it affects them quite negatively.
If you don't mind my asking, what were some of the symptoms when you were 12, and were these things that you had to fight against to do the kind of acting
mostly,
and writing you wanted to do, or did they feed that in any way?
Well, it was mostly physical tics, you know, nervousness kind of thing, that kind of thing, and, you know, like grunting and tics and, you know, kind of the classic Tourette's type syndrome, that type of thing. But by the time I was 14, it was allayed. And I really haven't had too much occurrence, except on the Asperger's side, where I have a fascination with police, and I always have to have a badge with me. You know, there's this guy in New York who radical Asperger's. He is a guy who goes down into the subway, and he pretends to be a motorman, and he gets on the trains in uniform and drives the subway.
Really?
Well, you know, that's a radical form of Asperger's. Well, me, I have a fascination with law enforcement and the police. I guess my grandfather was a Mountie in that, so... if I don't have a badge on me, I feel naked.
Well, I can't tell if you're kidding or not. I know you studied criminology when you were in college.
I did. I studied criminology. I had a great professor there. And that study of criminology really helped me when I wrote the Blues Brothers, because the Blues Brothers were classic recidivists, could never stay out of trouble, always looking for, you know, borderline sociopathic hedonists. And I wrote papers on motorcycle outlaw clubs. I wrote papers on the Detroit Mafia. I wrote papers in college. And when I came time to write the Blues Brothers, I was well armed with criminological terms and knowledge from my great professor Professor Hatt at Carleton University.
So, have you broken the law yourself outside of speeding tickets?
I was popped for marijuana possession in Marseilles, Illinois. It's so long ago now. I smoked it because I had a little problem with the back, and so the cop stopped me and at a stop sign, and he said, he plucked out the bag and said, "What's this?" And I said, "Well, it's just a little pot to help me drive across country." He said, "Well, I did all these. I used to do acid." He said, "I did acid and all this. Drugs are bad. And he took me in. And we sat down, and I said, "I'd like to see what you have in your drawer." And I looked in the drawer, and they had really much better stuff than I was carrying. I said, "Can we trade?" And they said, "No." And it turned out to be quite a nice evening. I talked with the young chief of police there, and he said, "Oh, we see this stuff all the time." I said, "What's going to happen to me?" He said, "You'll get a $50 fine. You won't even have to pay it. I mean, God, you know." So I gave it up. But what was quite alarming was I was driving across country, and it was on Dan Rather that night on the CBNO, a partner of John Belushi, a pop for possession of marijuana and arrested and all that. I didn't know where to go. So where do I go? I ran to Hunter Thompson's Colorado Estate. And I said, Hunter, you know, and he said, ah, forget it. You should have had speed. You'd had pills. You'd had all kinds of stuff. Come on in. I had a shotgun in the trunk. I had a riot shotgun, which luckily I had broken into two pieces. So when the cops searched my car, they saw I was a safe, you know, citizen and all that. And you know what? He still has that gun today, because I said I didn't want to drive to California with that. And so he's still got that shotgun today. But otherwise, other than that one arrest there, pretty much straight and legal.
Dan Aykroyd, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Take care.
Dan Aykroyd. His new book is called Elwood's Blues, Interviews with the Blues Legends and Stars. Here's some more of the Blues Brothers. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.